Adrian F. from Newark, Delaware.
It's an honest program.
Okay. You cracked it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi guys, I'm Adrian. I'm an alcoholic and clumsy. Oh, you guys have a timer and water. I'm not used to that. Thank you for having me and for asking me back. That wasn't a common theme in my life 4 years ago, so it's nice when people actually invite me back. And thanks for my brother and my friend for coming with me, because my sponsor bailed on me this morning and said, I'll be right there. And she was actually going to help someone else. And for like half a second, I was like, you bitch. And then I was like, it reminded me of when I think I had like, God, like not even 30 days. And she would set aside time for me every Sunday. And she lives in an apartment complex with a pool. So I thought, oh, I get to go swimming. That's great. This one Sunday came along, and she's like, yeah, so-and-so is coming over, because she couldn't come tonight because she was meeting someone else. And I was just appalled. I was like, excuse me? Like, you sponsor other people? And I kind of inherently knew this, but just the fact that it's my day and you're giving that to someone else, like, I was livid. And she's like, actually, it's a good time for you to start helping other people. And I was like, oh, no, not going to do that. And I tried to get her a thank you card, and she likes to drink Tab. Which if you know what that is, but I love it. But and I tried to give her that, and she said, that's nice, but that's not what I want. Like, I want you to go show what I've shown you to someone else. And it reminded me of another time when, like, after a meeting, I was, once again, she asked, I wanted to talk about me because it's my favorite subject, and she was like, I really think you should go up to that girl who's new, and you should talk to her and make her feel welcome. And I said, that's a horrible idea. I don't want to do that. And she said, she just repeated herself. And I'm like, okay, I guess I should go. I argued a lot when I first got here, even though I was really desperate. Like, the first time that she tried to take me to a Big Book meeting, I said that I had other plans. And she said, we're going to the movies afterwards. I said, okay, I'll go. Because she took me to the movies. And I was like, so I was bribed to my first Big Book meeting. But don't know where I was going with all that, but my sobriety date is June 15th, 2010. It wasn't my idea in the least bit. Sobriety looked like a horrible idea, honestly. I mean, I can't explain that any more than what it is, and mainly because sobriety was horrible for me. And thank God for good sponsorship and for a lot of beautiful people around me. Like, God just threw breadcrumbs through my path in the form of people so that I could just kind of follow. And she's taught me that there's a significant difference between recovery and sobriety. And I didn't know that when I got here. And one of the first places that I heard this message was this group, which is kind of funny looking back on it, because I had 2 months sober, maybe a little more. It was August, I think, 2010. And Julie was very patient with me. She really was. Like, she didn't pull any punches by any means. And neither did anybody else, because the people that I got thrown into, if you're new and you're not nauseous around them, you're probably not ready, because they're just so enthused about life and about being sober. And I just was like, you don't get to drink or do drugs. Like, why are you happy about this? Like, there's nothing to celebrate. It's kind of how I looked at it. And they're talking about God doing this and God doing that. I'm like, well, why is he helping you out? And it's not helping me. And now, mind you, the way they live their lives and the principles they're putting in their lives are significantly different than what I was doing, which was nothing. But I came to meetings a lot, and I flirted with guys, and I would go outside and smoke, but I don't smoke, so during meetings. And she kind of asked me about that once, and she's like, yeah, you don't smoke. I was like, well, I like to pretend, so I fit in, because it's important to fit in. She was like, well, I smoke, and I'm able to sit through a meeting for a full hour, so maybe you could try that. And I just was really offended and wanted to fire her, just because I've never been able to fire anyone, but I didn't, thank God. But anyway, I got really, really miserable really, really quickly, and I just hated everyone so much. It's hard to put it into words, like, how miserable I was. And I didn't understand. I just didn't get it, because I'm like, I'm not drinking. And it was just getting worse. And I couldn't articulate that. I couldn't put it to words because I wasn't really even fully conscious of what I was feeling because I felt that way my whole life. And it wasn't until I heard other people in this program share about that I was able to identify and be like, oh, yeah, I got that too. Oh, that's a thing? Okay, I get it. And I was waking up every morning, like, in full-blown panic attacks. Like, and there's nothing wrong. Like, I was at my parents' house. I don't know why they allowed me to stay there because I like to steal cars and their stuff. And they allowed me to come back. And as soon as I would wake up in these panic attacks, because it felt like just someone had their hand in my stomach and was twisting. And, like, there were bricks on my chest. And, like, I just hated myself. Like, there's no other way to put it. And I kind of rationalized it away and said, oh, it's post-acute withdrawal. It's fine. It's going to get better. The problem was it wasn't getting better. It was getting worse. And all of a sudden, everyone in AA is really stupid, and I'm brilliant. And and I just slowly, like, that ego just grew back, and that willingness was decreasing. And it was that day in August where those people, thank God, they were just like, get in the car. Please, just get in the car. And I'm too afraid to say no because what'll they think, you know? So God was using my defects to get me here. And I'm here, and they're like, there's this amazing speaker. You're going to love him. And I was like, he's horrible. He probably sucks. I don't want to hear anything he has to say. And if I was being honest with these people, I would have told them that fear kept me sober for a little bit. I had a relentless obsession, horrible obsession in it. To someone who hasn't experienced it, it's hard to describe, but it's just every cell in my body was screaming for liquor and drugs. And I came here, and it was outside, and a man spoke, a lawyer from Boston. And he just put into words everything I was feeling. Like, it felt like of the 100, it felt like 200 people were there, and it could have been. Like, it was just electric, and I don't know why I heard it. I don't know why, and that's how I know that this program is so God-given, because people were saying the same things Dave was saying around me. Like, looking back on it, they were. It was there. It was right in front of my face. But why in that moment I was able to absorb what he was saying, I don't know. And that started my journey. And it's been pretty magical thus far. And I think really screwed up the chronology of this talk, because I think you're supposed to talk about what you were like first. But anyway, when I think of Quakertown, I just think of how much gratitude I have for this meeting being here. Because if I hadn't, what if I'd have said no? what if my ego would have gotten in the way and said no, I'm not going? Or what if this group wouldn't have been here? I couldn't understand why he drove down from Boston, because I was appalled that they made me ride an hour and 20 minutes, because I'm like, there's a meeting 10 minutes from here, I don't understand. But it was his expression of gratitude that's the very minimum he could do to get back to AA was to sit in a car for a few hours. And I didn't get it then, but I get it now. Anyway, I think I touched on sponsored. Yeah. My home group is actually a Thursday night group in Havre de Grace. I just recently joined that group. It's great for a lot of reasons, but one of the best reasons is that I don't know if anyone's familiar with Father Martin Ashley Rehab in Aberdeen, but they bus over this whole bus of new girls, and I'm like one of the only ones. Like, there's girls there, but it's like a monopoly for new girls, so I just kind of sit there. And there's a lot of diversity, and they're very 12-step oriented, and it's nice. So if you're ever in that area, stop by. Home group sponsor. Yeah, I always forget to say I have a sponsor. It's such a given. Like, I forget that, like, when I got to AA, I didn't know what that was. I thought that was someone that was going to manage my life, tell me who to date, you know, give me money, all these things. And thank God that's not what she was by any means, but I didn't know any better. I love this timer. This is awesome. Because I always get lost. But I always, with a lot of the girls that I help, one of the biggest things, I guess, that the best kept secrets in AA, I feel like, at least this is my perception, is that my issue was never alcohol or the drugs. And I just didn't know that. Like, who would? Like, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous and alcohol. So I think alcohol, that's a problem. It's got to be. And my whole life, like, my grandmother used to say to me before she died and before she was completely gone with Alzheimer's, she would say, honey, just stop. You'll be fine. It's okay. And she was not alcoholic, clearly. But she would say things like, you're a 4.0 student. Like, what are you doing? And I was, and I just thought that insanity meant that I was stupid. Like, I came into AA the first time when I was 20, almost maybe 19. It's all a blur. It's all a blur. My early 20s, late teens. But I just didn't understand what alcoholism was, which is kind of ironic because I grew up in an alcoholic home. I just didn't know what an alcoholic really, really meant. I thought it was someone who broke stuff and yelled all the time and left for periods on end and stole things, you know, said really, really hurtful things, was violent. And those things do encompass some of us, at least in my story. They definitely manifested, but I didn't know that it was a spiritual malady. I didn't know. I was walking around with a mental obsession, not even aware of it. Like, that's what was really strange. But I always try to express to them that this problem started a long, long time ago before I ever used alcohol or drugs to medicate it. And there's, my whole life is written with examples of how this spiritual malady has gotten worse with time. Like, as a kid, I mean, I was having panic attacks at like 5. And I don't know what a 5-year-old has to have a panic attack about. And the thing was, like, I was experiencing this stuff before anything bad happened, like before any of the sexual abuse, before any of the physical abuse, before any of that stuff, I felt that way. And it took me a while to digest that, because I came into AA the first time, like a lot of people do as a victim. Like, if you experienced what I experienced, you certainly would drink the way that I drink. And so much so that this past time around, I was going to write a book on my life story because it was so important that Barnes & Noble was going to publish it. But I don't have the drive to finish it. I just got one chapter in, and I was like, because I'm really good at starting things, but I don't finish them. Anyway, when I was a kid, like, I just had this innate hatred for myself. I don't know where it came from. I wasn't raised that way, even though I was raised in an alcoholic home. Like, my mom overly compensated to try to teach me right from wrong. And I do know right from wrong. I always did. It's just that I didn't operate on that scale. I operated on convenient, inconvenient. Whatever works for me is what I'm going with. And people call me selfish all the time, and I'm just like, you're just not as smart as I am, so you don't see things like I do. That's okay. and it was just so arrogant. But I was constantly like evaluating other people and like trying to mimic them almost, and you know, maybe I could fit in with this person, or it always just seemed like everyone else had it together and I needed to figure it out so that I could feel together. And the more I tried to do that, the worse it got. Like trying to manufacture friendships with people based on lies, because I'm just so desperate for you to accept me. Desperate. I mean, this one guy I dated, like, he was a hunter. And, like, no offense, I'm sure some of you guys are hunters, but I can't do it. And I lied and said that I like to go hunting and I like country music, two of things I'm not familiar with. But, like, I study you and then try to make you think that I like those things so you'll like me. Heaven forbid should I have an opinion or an interest that, you know, isn't like yours, because what will you think? And my sponsor pointed out, she said, do you have a wand or something, like, that you understand what other people are thinking? And I'm like, yeah. I mean, I legitimately live my life that way, is reading minds. And my mom pointed out, like, I would say things like, there's just voices all the time. And she's like, well, why don't they ever say anything nice? Like, why don't they say, Adrian, have a great day. Like, it's good. And it's always like, they hate you. Like, they're going to find out. I don't know what they're going to find out, but they're going to find out. So you better put on the facade. And, like, I had this ego that I thought when I got to AA meant self-confidence. So I was like, well, I don't have an ego problem, thanks. And which I do very much so. But it was just this distance that I put between myself and other people. And with women, hated women so much because they're jealous or they're can't be trusted or they're vicious or they're all these things. And I said no one could possibly understand the pain that I'm in. And thank God, once again, for people being around me. They're like, you've never given anyone a chance to. Because I also thought intimacy meant sex. And once again, I make up my own definitions for things. And intimacy just, to me now, means showing someone who you really are. And I was never able to do that because I was so afraid of what you were going to say. And as a result of living my life that way, I made those fears come true because I was either so clingy to you and obsessed with you, especially if you were doing something for me, like giving me attention or money or alcohol or anything, or else I just didn't even look at you because I'm so much better than you, because really I'm just afraid. So as a result, like, I never feel connected to anybody, and it's so lonely. It's so lonely. Like, I really, it moves me when I hear people talk about how lonely this disease is, because it is. For me, it was. It just felt like I was the only person on this earth. And the reason that I emphasize that is because when I was drinking, I no longer felt that way. It was pretty magical, mainly because I just didn't care what you thought anymore. I no longer had mind-reading powers, or maybe I did, but it was all of a sudden like, well, it's a really good thing Adrienne's here because she saved the party, like just walking in. Or maybe it's just that it doesn't matter what's going on out here. I felt okay in here. And once again, like the first time I got drunk, I wasn't able to put that to words. I just knew I felt better. Like that's all I could say is I felt better. My first drink was not healthy, I guess. Like, it was by myself on New Year's Eve with Peach Schnapps watching a Three Stooges marathon, and that's really sad. Like, there was no, it was really dark and gray, and I don't remember much about it because I remember watching people, like, make fuzzy navels with orange juice, and I, after the first one, I just discarded the orange juice, and I put the bottle back in the fridge so I wouldn't get in trouble. The empty bottle back in the fridge, I know that, but it's like that allergy kind of kicked in right away. But surprisingly, I didn't pursue it at 12, 13, on however old I was, because I was one of those kids in high school who degraded people like us. I was so much better than all of you. And I made a promise to myself that I wasn't going to be like my dad. I hated him with everything in me, like that wake you up in the morning type of hatred. Like, I just didn't know how to be. And, like, I would sit in the cafeteria, or I would not sit in the cafeteria in high school because I was just so offended by your presence. Like, I went in the bathroom by myself and ate lunch, or I pretended I was doing homework in the library. And if you would have asked me, why are you sitting in the library? It's like, because I have to get into college, clearly. I wouldn't eat because I was so obsessed with how I looked. Just a full-blown mess. But I binge drank, and I pursued other things up until that point, especially when I made that promise to myself that I would never be like him. I kind of pursued other things very alcoholically, like sports. I did that. I played for four different teams in the same season at once. I exercised to a point where, like, I almost hurt myself. I was in fantastic shape, and made sure everyone else knew that, like, how fantastic I was. But I just was so discontent all the time. Like, my mom would constantly say, like, you wouldn't be happy in a pie factory. And I'm like, no, I wouldn't, because I wouldn't eat the pie. So that's a bad analogy. Go on. Like, neurotic. Just neurotic. And I thought that my whole take on relationships was so screwed up. Like, my parents should have locked me up at, like, six. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, no boys for you. Like, just no. Because I was watching Beauty and the Beast at, like, eight, and that's my favorite. And I just couldn't get it. Like, I couldn't get it. Like, I was so upset with the ending of that movie. And I think there's some underlying moral themes about, like, not judging people by the outside. And because I thought Gaston was really hot. I'm like, he wants to kill the whole village for you and burn it down. Like, why are you going with the Beast? Like, just because he's nice? Like, just, and I voiced this to my mom, and she was just like, honey, maybe you should watch it again. Like, maybe you'll get it when you're older. I didn't at all. Like, it got worse. Like, I would pick men that were just, whew. Like, one of my biggest resentments against my mom was that she hated, like, despised this one winner that I brought home. He was, and I shouldn't, he's sick. Like, he's not doing well now at all from what I understand. But he was a chef at Denny's overnight, and he had 60 UIs, and he had track marks, and I brought him home so drunk with his shirt off, and I'm like, Mom, isn't he nice? Like, and she's like, what? Like, are you serious? Like, I would just move guys into their house, like, just without asking, or, like, even if that's normal at 17, I don't know. I emptied my bank account for the man sober. Like, that took me a while to take a look at that, but that's how desperately, like, I needed you. Because if I had a man, that meant that I was worth something. That meant that other people would look at me and say, oh, well, she must be somewhat okay if someone's willing to hang out with her. And that's how I thought. And, I mean, how selfish is that, to use another person to make other people, like, it's just messed up. I thought that I was a really loyal person until I did my 4-step. And my sponsor kind of described it as, you are loyal to anyone who has what you think you need to feel better. That was the truth. Like, I thought that it didn't count if they cheated first and then you did. Like, it cancels each other out. Like, it doesn't count, right? And that was legitimate. Like, that's how I thought. And she's like, no, actually, that's not the truth. But I used that for a while. And then, like, all these things work really, like, the hole's, like, in here somewhere. Because whenever, I feel my spirit, like, it's weird. It's in here. I don't know why. But the hole, like, I think was also in here. I don't know. It's weird. But the older I got, the bigger the hole got. And, like, as I started to progress with my drinking, the things that I was doing to continue drinking was, like, pouring fertilizer on the hole. Like, it was getting worse with time. And the alcohol can only fill it so far. Like, it's limited. And it got to a point where I'm drinking and I still feel horrible. That was the worst, hands down. Aside from being at family functions when I still used to show up trying to pretend to be sober when you're not, that was the worst, is that I really turned to alcohol for everything. Like, no matter what was going on the outside, if I had a bottle, you could say an asteroid's coming for Earth, I'm like, it's fine. It's fine. Like, it gave me a form of peace with myself and with other people. The world didn't seem so scary, and I felt alive. For the first time, I really felt alive. And if it continued to do that for me, I don't bullshit people. I would absolutely still be doing it, hands down. DUI, that's not a big deal. Like, consequences have never deterred me. Outside consequences, I should say. I've lost everything material that I think you can. House. I love to pawn cars. I don't know why. I pawned two. Don't do that. If anyone's going to go, but don't do the title loan thing. That's not right. Don't do that. It's just, it never ends well. That was a big financial amends, and it was painful. So if you're going to go back out, just don't do that. Just saying, like, just a warning. I lost the house. I lost, like, boyfriends would try to tell me to slow down, and that was always cute because I would get really violent and, like, say some really, like, venomous stuff, like, why don't you mind your own business? Like, who asked you? You know, just, I'd throw bottles. I tried to run him over once. He moved. It's fine. Like, I didn't. Like, it's just, it wasn't good. I mean, it was really bad. And the thing that was really sad is that the only thing that I was afraid of when I was out there was running out. Like, that's the only thing that I was afraid of, was running out. And you would think, like, being so sick that I can't even move. Like, I don't withdraw well, and especially from opiates, like, I just get nuts. I get suicidal. I threaten to break people and things. Like, I just, it's horrible, the things that I put people that loved me through. And you would think, like, that in itself would have been enough of a consequence for me to be like, yeah, you probably shouldn't do that anymore, because you remember what happened? And every single time, my mind just didn't have the ability to pull those memories out and say, hey, because it was always, you know what, you're just not going to hang out with him, or maybe you should just drink, maybe you should just do this, maybe you should just mix it with this, maybe you should get another job, you need to get back to college, you need a scholarship back, you were better when you were playing, like just constant rationalizations. And it's, my mom worked, she was a bartender up until she had me. And she knows a lot of the people in the area that are in AA now because she used to serve them. And, like, they've been sober, like, 20 years. So she'd always, like, come in my room, and she'd either have an obituary of someone that I knew that drank like I did, and my response was always the same, which is they didn't know what they were doing. Or she would come in with pamphlets. She'd make me take that stupid test on all those rehab websites that, like, I answer yes to everything, but it still, that doesn't count. Constantly like telling me about these people in AA that she knew that got better. And I'm just like, I don't drink Kool-Aid, Mom. Like, sorry. Like, this is how I am. You need to accept me. I'm your daughter. You said you just wanted me to be happy. I'm happy. I'm dying, but I'm happy. Like, just a mess. And, it kind of came to a head in, God, my brain, 2009, 2010. I was sleeping in this trailer on a deflated air mattress with my cardboard box that was wet of possessions, like a lighter and, like, just random shit with, like, bills unpaid. My voicemail, that's the only reason my mom continued to pay for a phone, is because she would still try to call me because I would just disappear for months. Or I'd be in some hotel with, like, I'd put, like, the sheets off the bed over top of the windows because I don't want to see the daylight. Just dying. And I got a phone call that my grandfather died. And the first thing that I should say that about my grandparents is that they did not make my fourth step, which is incredible because everyone was on my fourth step. I hated everyone. But they never did anything to me that I perceived was deserved my resentment. And he died pretty suddenly, and the last time I heard his voice was on a voicemail, because I don't listen to my voicemail when I'm out there, because it's usually someone that I've ripped off or family members begging to know I'm alive. And there was one of him, he was crying, 83-year-old man crying, just saying, I just want to hear your voice. I'm not going to lecture you, because he never did. I just want to know you're alive, that's it. And I'm a coward, I can't call him back. And I didn't, and that was, he died, and I was so obliterated at his funeral, I don't remember it. And just, my mom was devastated. She's got an alcoholic daughter, she has an alcoholic husband, and her mother has severe Alzheimer's. She's working two jobs, trying to hold everything together. And the only thing I can think to do in a situation like that is to go in her room after the funeral and pretend I'm crying over pictures when I'm really going through my dead grandfather's wallet. And when she called me on it later, like, my response, like, genuine response was, well, he didn't need it. Like, I just was so, we can't differentiate the true from the false, because that's the only normal life that I had at that point. And I remember there were times, like, when my little brother blocked the door, because he's 10 years younger than me, and he knew where I was going. And I literally, I love that kid like a son, because he's so much younger than me. And my dad was gone a lot. My mom worked two jobs, which I resented her for, but even though we had everything that we ever needed. And I just picked him up and tossed him out of the way. And I'm walking to my car, and I'm bawling my eyes out because I can't stop what I'm doing. Like, I would have taken a bullet for that kid, but yet when that obsession's on, like, you can't come between me and that. Like, I'll protect it with everything in me. And that wasn't enough. Like I said, consequences don't deter me. But what happened in 2010 is really strange, because when I got sober, there were worse things that happened. Like, this is how I know that, like, it was definitely God. But my mom had allowed me to detox for, like, the millionth time. I'd been to a few detoxes by this point, two, I think. But maybe one. Like I said, it's a blur. But I think I had, like, 5 or 6 days sober, and that obsession is just relentless at this point. I'm not shaking as much anymore, but, like, it's just all in here. And by this point, like, when I know that I go back to it, I know that it's not going to be any different. It's going to be worse, but my head is just like, you're just a piece of shit, and this is what you do. You don't have a chance. Like, you're going to die this way. And I'd been to AA prior, but like I said, I just wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to listen to anybody. And she's outside, and it's a beautiful May day. And I love summer. Like, this weather kills me, but I love summer. I remember, like, alcohol used to make my world so big and colorful. Like, I kind of equate it to when Dorothy walks out and she realizes she's not in Kansas anymore and everything's in color and everything just seems more hopeful and just better. And it no longer did that. It kind of did the reverse of my world was so small and dark. And no matter what I did, things just seemed to get worse. And she's trying to convince me to live because suicide was on my mind every day. And like my version of trying to kill myself was I just wouldn't wear seatbelts. It's pretty pathetic, but like whenever I'd go anywhere. And but I'm just explaining to this poor woman who's, God, she got an A for effort, like for trying to pull me out of it. It's just that like frothy emotional appeal, like it doesn't work for people like me. And she's telling me, like, you can have babies. Like, and prior to this, like, one of my biggest delusions as an alcoholic is I think my head is a problem solver. It's not. It's a problem creator most of the time. And I went up to her, like, with one of my ideas. I said, Mom, I think I'm going to sell my eggs. And she was like, what? And I was like, I hear you get, like, $7,000 a pop. And that would solve everything. And, like, I'm legitimately telling her this. Like, this was a good idea. And she just started bawling, like, her eyes out. Like, what happened to you? Like, that look of, like, what is wrong with you? And I couldn't answer that question because I'm insane. But so babies, like, I tried to get pregnant when I was out there. I really did because I heard that women were able to stop for 9 months. And if that isn't, like, self-centered to the core, I don't know what is, because thank God, number one, that I didn't, because it's not that I respected the man that I was with or that I wanted to love and nurture another human being or be a role model or help just be a mom. That was not on the radar at all. I wanted to stop using and drinking, so I was going to use my unborn child to do that, and I thought, well, everyone would have to love me, and my mom would have to let me live there, and people would have to give me money, so seems like it should work. Didn't work, thank God. But at this point, like I said, on the May day, she's trying to convince me to live, and I'm just not hearing it. And I decided to take her checkbook and write out happy graduation, $500, and, you know, because she accidentally left the checkbook out because they lock stuff up when I stay there in the safe. And I wasn't raised that way. I really wasn't. It's just that that's where it took me. And that $500 didn't even last me 2 days, I don't think. And once they figured it out, they said, we're calling the cops, or you can go to rehab. And at this point, I'm like, can I please think about it? Because what's a rehab going to do? It's like jail, and it's not. But I asked that weekend. I couldn't get into Bowling Green. And pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is crying on your knees to your mother, like begging her to kill you or to get you something because I don't want to live. Like, that's basically what I did for the whole weekend. And thank God Bowling Green let me in because I didn't look at it that way. Like I said, being sober was, it didn't look like a good idea because I tried that so many times, never with AA, but it just was painful. And as this progressed, like being sober was just intolerable. Like, all the shame and the guilt and just the malady was just horrible. Couldn't stand it. I would have nightmares if I slept sober, if I was able to sleep, period. Because there was years where, like, there not a day went by when there wasn't something in my body. And intentionally, I should say. But I get to Bowling Green, and I had somewhat of a spiritual experience there. Several, actually. Because the first night, I was detoxing, and it was vicious, and I remember that, like, I'm twitching and just sweating and just praying for death, and I realized there was no one on this earth that I could have called in that moment that would have helped me or came to pick me up or that I could just call a friend because, and rightfully so, the way that I lived, but there was no one left, and there's such a, like, we will know loneliness such as few do. because I just really was at a point where I'm like, I can't live like this anymore because it's so exhausting. And I didn't want to die. I just didn't see another way. I guess that's the best way I can put it, is I just didn't see another way. And I get in there and I detox, and I finally, my ears start to perk up a little bit. And they brought this like Scare You Straight team in, which might work if you're not one of us, but they brought in all these like Philly cops. And by this point, like, I am Miss Rehab. Like, I am giving marriage advice. I've never been married. I am like inspecting people's rooms for food. Mind you, I'm hiding food under my pillow. Like, just a mess. But I'm there, and they want me to chair meetings. And I called my mom and told her, and she was like in tears because she's like, I'm just so proud. Like, I had aspirations to be a doctor at one point, and then, like, she's, like, excited that I'm rehab, like, chairperson. But she goes, like, she's just poor thing. But the Scare You Straight team comes in. And, like, the first time in my life, I really wanted to be sober. Like, I did want this. And I had wanted it for a long time because if you think about it, like, this isn't a choice because no one of sound mind would put themselves through that ever and put the people that they love through that. If you look at the last year, maybe multiple years, I think it's pretty obvious. But I come in, I'm Miss Rehab, and like they're showing pictures of like Jack Daniels, and then a graphic scene of an accident, and then they're showing needles, and then like a graphic scene of an overdose, and my head is screaming like, "You don't want to do this anymore. You don't want to do this anymore," and I'm foaming at the mouth, like looking at this stuff. And thank God for that experience, because it was in that moment where I was like, I'm going to die, like, if I don't get help, like, if I'm not serious about this, because all the other times I wasn't very serious. I said I was. I always knew the language and what to say, but it was in that moment where I was like, I have no clue. I'm going to die if I leave here. Like, I felt like when Dr. Young told Roland Hazard you need to lock yourself up or you need to hire a bodyguard. Like, that's how I felt. And I went to this counselor who seemed like she had her shit together, and she seemed kind of crazy, and I liked that. And I asked her what I should do about this dilemma, and I thought I was waiting for a really profound answer, and looking back at it now, it probably was, but she told me to go pray. And I was just like, do you hear yourself? Like, do you really hear yourself? Like, this just the most lame answer. And but the thing was, it was the only answer at that point. It was the only answer. And I went, and I don't even really remember what I said. I think the theme of it was something like, I need some help, so if you're there, I'm here. And I cried and cried and cried, and I did sleep that night. And when I got out, I went to a meeting in Delaware. I didn't even think I was alcoholic, honestly. I really didn't, because that meant I was like my dad, and that also meant I thought I was just a junkie, because that's much cooler. And it's not even close. My own personal definition of my alcoholism is that I was going to go to the other fellowship and then still drink because that's acceptable. And apparently they don't like that either, but that's not what happened. Because my idea of that is like I drink wine and take Suboxone and do online NA meetings, and that worked. But anyway, I got out, and I ended up at an AA meeting, of all places, in Newark, Delaware. I live in Maryland. And a beautiful man was out front. He's not with us anymore. But he was just so sweet. And I walk in. It's like 6:15. It's a 6:30 beginner's meeting. And I didn't want to be late for class. And I remember from college that people that got A's in the class sat up front. So I did that. And I'm sitting there, like, shaking, and I'm, like, 20 pounds less than what I am now. I mean, jaundiced. I thought I looked hot, but, like, I was looking like a mess. And he said, don't you know this is a men's meeting? And I almost threw up on him. And I, like, went to bolt, and he grabbed my arm, and he's like, I'm just kidding, Angel. It's fine. Just sit. Here's some coffee and apple pie. And I was like, you guys got a sick sense of humor around here. But there's another one there, too, who's just... He's hot. And I heard in AA, or not in AA, I wasn't really in it, but in my rehab, they said that you have to get a female sponsor and you have to want what she has. And I only heard the want what they have part. And I figured, well, you know, I'm sure other people do that, but I'm special, so I don't have to abide by that. And which is another reason I parked in handicapped parking lots my whole life, like the spot, like just because I'm special. And I don't do that anymore. But and I went up to him, and I was, because he was chairing the meeting, so I thought that meant like he was high up on the hierarchy of AA. And I was just like, so do you go to a lot of meetings? And he just said, the women stick with the women. And he gave me like a grandpa hug, like when he handed me my meeting list. And I said, well, I had like 3 years. And I was just out of rehab. But he said, I thought you just said you got Bowling Green. I was like, yeah, but yeah, bye. Again, I just bolted. But I thought that he would be back the next day. So I figured, oh, well, I can go. And he wasn't. But my sponsor was up there. And she was sharing about how she was losing her house and bankrupt, and her daughter was gone, and like all this stuff, and she was just so nonchalant about it, like just very peaceful. She mentioned some things that I kind of related to. I don't really remember a lot of what she said, but I remember how I felt. And she took me to a diner and bought me a Diet Pepsi, and I cried because I was just so moved that you bought me a Diet Pepsi and you don't want me to do anything, or you just want to talk to me, like I don't have to pay you to listen, because most of the therapists were even getting tired of me. And she did listen, and I told her in a general way what I thought my problem was, and she listened. She listened, and then she said, well, because she asked me what I thought I needed to do to stay sober and to stay happy while doing so, and I told her I needed a boyfriend immediately, and I needed a lot of money, and I needed my softball scholarship back, and I needed to be away from my parents, because they're the ones that are causing me all this. Like, I would say to my mom, like, you're disturbing my serenity, and they say that if you do that, that I drink, so you don't want that, right? Like, you should go away. Like, just horrible things. And anyway, like, she said, it's funny you told me how you had all those things before, but yet you were still drinking yourself to death. And that was the first time someone had said that to me, and I had to agree with the logic, even though I didn't like it. And she said, why don't we just go through this process and see what happens? And she did promise that if I did this, that a God was going to come into my life that I would understand and I won't want to drink anymore. And I was like, well, that's not really a car or anything, but I guess it'll have to do. And, so much more came. I did a fourth step, and it was paragraphs, and it was a mess, and I didn't follow direction, and I lied to her the first time I did it, and didn't get any results, and was walking around AA saying how AA doesn't work because I'm special, and God. And she told me to go meditate, and I fell asleep because I was too arrogant to say I didn't know how. And she, once again, was patient. That's when I found you guys. When I was just ready, I was flirting with it, because I just couldn't stand myself anymore, and I was getting worse day by day. And if I stay in that long enough, I go insane, or I think I was insane because I never really got any better, but anymore today, like, if I don't treat this, like, I can't see the truth about myself, and pretty soon I can't see the truth about anything, including a bottle. And once I start that up, it's like I put myself on a ride I can't get off, and I burn my life to the ground, and I'm just so grateful that we have a disease that's treatable, because there's so many that aren't. And I made my amends, and I finally got to a point after this meeting where I asked someone for help that I thought was arrogant, that I thought was, couldn't stand them. And Julie is my sponsor, and it took a village to get me to where I am now, but it's God used those words, because I had no intention of asking this person for help, and it just kind of came out. And the first time, the same person that welcomed me when I, with the men's meeting thing, I was standing outside of a meeting, and there was this girl crying in her car, and he said, you should go up to her and talk to her. And I did, and which was weird, because I never thought about anybody but me. And I went up, and I just asked how she was, and I told her she didn't have to feel that way anymore if she didn't want to. And I just shared the things I'd been doing, and I only had like two and a half months maybe at this point. And she let me help her through the steps. I never said the sponsor word because I was afraid she'd run. But it's funny, during that period, she never asked me how long I had. She just saw my hand out. And that's what I've done ever since, honestly. And it's grown and it's changed, and God has shown up in ways in my life that are really weird. But you can't deny that it's there. And as long as I stay in that spiritual realm, it grows. And my life today is not something that I would have picked, because I didn't even know what to hope for. I measured success by the material world, like by cars and money and what people thought of me. And it says, like, all our old ideas need to go. And, like, my ideas about success change. Like, when I get up in the morning, I don't like early mornings, but I do like waking up, not shaking. And I like being able to pray and to meditate, which I haven't been doing in the morning. I'm just going to tell myself, because I'm supposed to be, and I do at night. But and I get to show up for other people and be a daughter and be a sister as a result of this stuff. And there's some things going on in my life that are pretty rocky. My parents are in the middle of a pretty vicious divorce after almost 30 years. And it's a good thing. It is a good thing. It's just that my dad won't talk to me. He won't talk to any of us, and he's kind of doing what we do. And his family kind of has sided with them a little bit. And it's funny, like, when we needed family the most, last winter, there's this member who's not a member right now, I guess, but I just loved him so much, named Barry. And he was really struggling, and my mom made fried chicken because he was from the South. And I was like, you should just come over, and we should talk. And, like, I invited, like, 10 people. I don't know why. He didn't show up, because that's kind of what we do. But all 10 people did. And then we're like, well, let's try again next weekend. And we did. And Barry didn't show up again. But then more people came. And then we're like, well, let's just have a meeting. So now there's Big Book Me in my house on Sundays with, like, 40 people. And it's crazy, but it's God gave me a family. Like, how does that work? Like, God knows what I need and what's in my heart before I really even know. And I've got to see both of my brothers come into the program. It's just been incredible. I'm getting married next August. That's weird, to the guy that I tried to hit on at my first meeting. Because I got sober and sane, and I guess it worked out. That's crazy, because I don't know how to do that. I don't. Like, I'm not. I was the girl that you didn't bring home to your parents. And the one time that he tried to, I passed out in the middle of their living room floor, and he drugged me and hid me in the closet. And I woke up, and I was like, well, maybe we can try next weekend. You know, like, just crazy. I'm not that. I'm not wife material. And I don't mind my life. I really like it today. And that's not something that I could say before. I hated every minute. And I have friends. Lots of them. Like, a fellowship has grown up around us, because helping other women is just, it's just my life. That's just part of it. Because the more I do it, the more I see God and the more love I feel. And I'm not as afraid anymore. I still get that way. But when I get that way, I don't have to be prisoner to it, and I can do something about it. And all I can really say is that if you haven't experienced this, like, please don't sell yourself short. Like, there's so much love to be had. Like, there's so much life to live. I know that sounds corny, but it's true. Like, you don't have to suffer anymore if you don't want to. And there's a lot of people I know here that can help. So thanks for letting me share.